This has been brewing for hundreds of years in some ways.
Philippine voters decide on regional autonomy. It's Tuesday, January 22nd. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Glad to have you with us. Join us as well on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, climate change is on Australia's mind. Christians persecuted in China. A Chinese delicacy has Ugandan fishermen upset. Regaining space sight and remembering a civil rights champion. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Muslims in the southern Philippines voted Monday in a referendum on new autonomous region that seeks to end nearly a half century of unrest in what their leaders are touting as the best alternative to a new wave of Islamic State group-inspired militants. VOA Asia's Ira Melman spoke via Skype about the referendum with Roger Baker, Senior Vice President of Strategic Analysis at the American Geopolitical Intelligence Platform, Stratfor.
This has been brewing for hundreds of years, in some ways. The issue in the southern Philippines, in that when you think about the Philippines, the southern Philippines has primarily been a Muslim region. The northern Philippines has been a Christian Catholic region. The Bangso Moro issue was a problem for Spanish colonization. It was a problem for American ownership or occupation of the Philippines. And it has continued to be an issue that has divided the Philippines in its modern era. And it has spawned militancy, it has spawned terrorism, and it has spawned violence. And the vote that we're seeing taking place today is the culmination of multiple phases of trying to come to terms with the interest groups in the southern Philippines and bring them more actively into both the governance of the southern Philippines and into a peaceful relationship within the entire country.
So what does this entail? We remember back, I think it was 2017, that troops, including a U.S. or an Australian surveillance, routed the militants who occupied Marawi for 5 months, and it left more than 1,200 people, most of them Islamic fighters, dead. So what happened after that? I mean, how did we come to today?
In previous peace accords, there was an agreement to create the autonomous region of Muslim Mindanao, which had some local governance, and that had been a deal with the Moro National Liberation Front, which was a different group that was related to the current MILF. They had created a certain element of local governance within the southern Philippines, but that had not ended large-scale militancy. Then the government worked first in competition and in conflict with, and then in a peace accord with the MILF to create this space for this vote for expanding the construct of what was the ARMM into now what will be the ARMM. But the Marawi incident was one that fit within this context. That was a smaller group. It was a splinter group off of some of the other militancies and some of the other sub-ethnic groups within there. It was inspired and connected to the Islamic State. And one of the things that we see with these larger Muslim, formerly militant groups in the southern Philippines is they're looking for some way to create economic benefits for their people. And that means that this is the government of the Philippines working with these larger militant organizations to try to control some of these smaller terrorist groups like we saw in Marawi City.
So if this passes, goes into effect, as we are led to believe will happen when the vote count comes out in the next few days or so, what happens?
Well, if it passes, and right now it's looking cautiously positive that it will pass, this creates a need for a new round of elections, for an expanded organization within the southern Philippines to be able to have some element of autonomous power over economic development, over social policies within the southern Philippines. And then there's going to be a question, if this vote passes, for a few other parts of the southern Philippines to decide if they want to join this new broadened entity. The challenge for the Philippines is going to be to get the different interest groups within the southern Philippines to agree and to cooperate and to come up with an agreement that not everybody is going to get exactly what they want in any new election. There are interest elements that have established themselves under the ARMM, and they are quite happy with where they're at. New entities, new individuals are going to have some greater share in that power. And that's probably going to be what we're going to be watching for next is, yes, there's some space for some calming of the broader tensions within the Southern Philippines. Now we're ideally pushing into more of a political rather than a militant process.
How safe is this? Some Western governments, although they're welcoming the PAC, we understand, they worry that some IS-linked militants from the Middle East and Southeast Asia could forge an alliance with these Filipino insurgents and turn the South into a breeding ground for extremists?
I think that that's a slightly unfounded risk. What we've seen in the Southern Philippines, what we've seen through Indonesia, through Malaysia, is that in fact, Al-Qaeda and IS have had a difficult time establishing broad-based links within those areas. The development of Islam in those areas in Southeast Asia was very different than we've seen in some other parts of the world, in the Middle East in particular. And so, yes, there are aspects within the Southern Philippines that may be open to that ideology, that may be seeking to link in and connect into it, that may allow for a continuation of certain elements of militancy and terrorism. But the ability to connect to a broad-based movement within that space doesn't necessarily seem to fit the cultural and social patterns of Islam as it's developed in the Southern Philippines.
Roger Baker, Senior Vice President of Strategic Analysis at the American Geopolitical Intelligence Platform, Stratfor, speaking with VOA Asia's Ira Melman. These are among some of the top Asia stories that you'll find right now when you visit voanews.com. Indonesian presidential debate highlights disagreements. China's strategy to unify with Taiwan sparks anger. A complicated path to denuclearization as Trump-Kim summit nears. China's 2018 economic growth edges down amid trade war. North Korean art troupe to visit China. You'll find much more, including photos and videos, expanded coverage, on Facebook at VOA Asia, as well as the voanews.com website. The way Asia continues, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison has wrapped up a 3-day trip to the South Pacific to reassure vulnerable island nations that Canberra is serious about tackling climate change. We hear more from Phil Mercer in Sydney.
Scott Morrison has told Pacific Island leaders that Australia would meet its international obligations to reduce carbon emissions in line with the Paris Climate Change Agreement. Many low-lying communities fear that rising sea levels will force them from their homes. In Samoa, coastal villages are already making plans to relocate to higher ground in the nation's volcanic interior. Morrison's 3-day trip to Vanuatu and Fiji has been described by foreign policy experts as mostly a success. However, climate change remains a source of friction between Australia and its smaller neighbours. Fiji's Prime Minister Frank Bainimarama criticised Canberra for not doing more to cut greenhouse gas emissions and reduce the economy's reliance on coal. Australia has some of the world's highest per capita rates of carbon pollution. Australia is also eager to counter China's growing strategic influence in the South Pacific, although Morrison insists all countries should work together.
We're here because we're for the independent sovereignty and prosperity of Vanuatu, because they're our Pacific neighbours and family. That's why we're here. Our objectives and our motives here, I think, are very transparent to our family and friends here in the Pacific, particularly here in Vanuatu. This question's put to me all the time. I mean, we don't have to choose. We just have to work cooperatively together.
Australia has also mended a previously fraught relationship with Fiji. Prime Minister Bainimarama is a former commander of the Fijian military, who deposed an elected government in 2006. Democracy was restored to Fiji, an archipelago of about 900,000 people, in 2014. Pacific nations have debts of about $4 billion. Creditors include the World Bank and the Asian Development Bank, while $1 billion is owed to China. Experts say that some South Pacific countries have preferred to take out loans from China rather than accept grants from Australia because the process was more simple and less bureaucratic. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Happening now in Asia, Chinese President Xi Jinping held talks aimed at strengthening bilateral relations with Cambodian Prime Minister Hun Sen in Beijing. The visit was intended to improve trade diversification and strengthen political mutual trust between China and Cambodia based on close bilateral relations. Stay up to date with VOA and VOA 60. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad to have you with us today on VOA Asia. China has been waging a movement against Christian churches, recently arresting Pastor Wang Yi and members of his unregistered or underground Early Rain Covenant Church in the southwest city of Chengdu. Human Rights Watch said the December shutdown of the Protestant church epitomizes what it called President Xi Jinping's relentless assault on religious freedom in China. It said the church, including a kindergarten, offices, seminary, and Bible college, were ransacked and sealed, private homes searched, and some members beaten. Wang Yi was charged with inciting subversion of state power. The rights group described the pastor as an outspoken critic of the Chinese Communist Party. Ian Johnson is a Beijing-based writer for such publications as the New York Times and has authored the book The Souls of China, The Return of Religion After Mao, a reference to China's Communist Party founder Mao Zedong. He tells VOA's Victor Beatty Beijing embarked on a crackdown on religious groups 2 years ago with new regulations that tightened control of religious life.
There is this religious revival going on in China. And to some degree, the government thinks that it can be useful for the government as a way of building values and binding people together in society. But on the other hand, they're worried that religion can become a force that's outside of government control. So they have these new regulations in place and have been slowly tightening the screws on groups that are not registered with the government, that are independent of government control. And this is probably the most prominent church in China that is not registered with the government. And so it was almost just a matter of time before they went after it.
What happens to these people once they're detained? Are they kept incarcerated for a long period of time?
Most of them are detained for 24 hours. The police has the right to detain people for 24 hours. There have been some reports and photos that have been circulated on social media that seem to show that people were roughed up a bit. And basically, they're meant to be scared a little bit and then released. And then the government will, however, go after the leaders of the church. Wang Yi, to my knowledge, is still in detention. The elders of the church, the people that run the church, a couple of them are still in detention. A couple of others have been released but are under house arrest. Well, I don't know if they'll jail them formally, arrest them and try them, but they could be put under house arrest. There's been precedent for this before where people are essentially held under house arrest for years and years.
By one account, more than 100,000 Chinese Christians have been detained this year, more than three times as many as last year.
Yes, this is part of the overall crackdown on religious groups that the government is worried about. The government sees some religions as potentially useful allies. In a way, you could think of it as analogous to Vladimir Putin's Russia, where he's embraced the Orthodox Church, and the Orthodox Church, to some degree, has embraced Putin, and it's sort of a pillar of his support. The Chinese Communist Party, although it's called a Communist Party, it's supposed to be atheist. In fact, it's sort of similar to Putin's Russia in that it sees some religions like Buddhism, Taoism, folk religions as being useful, and other religions like Christianity and Islam as more problematic, potential enemies or challengers, and so they're going hard after these groups.
Ian Johnson said the crackdown has been far more severe in rest of northwest Xinjiang territory, where more than 1 million ethnic Muslims holding what are called strong religious views have been sent to so-called re-education camps, prompting international calls for access to them. China said the camps are to protect the country from terrorism while providing vocational training. Coming up, Chinese diners love them. Ugandan fishermen, well, less and less.
You're listening to VOA Asia.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
This news from VOA Asia, former South Korean national team skating coach Jeon Myung-yoo has denied he attempted to cover up alleged sex abuse by his students. Jeon has long been accused of nepotism for favoring athletes and coaches from the school in international competition. Visit VOA 60 and VOA Asia Facebook each day. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, the sale of Nile perch fish maw in Uganda has become a lucrative business, especially for distributors. The fish maw, or dried swim bladder, is used as an aphrodisiac in China. But Ugandan fishermen bringing in the perch say they're being exploited while others are reaping the profits. Atumani Halima reports from Kampala.
Idris Awalusimbi began working as a fisherman 20 years ago. Now he has his own boat and is chairman of the Fish Protection Unit. He recalls when mostly locals enjoyed the Nile perch fish maw, but now much of it is exported to China, where it's considered an aphrodisiac. Awalusimbi says fish maw prices have jumped, but fishermen see little of the profit.
You find that from the lowest fisherman, as you know, that he gains, but not so much. Then you find the middleman gains more, and the trader above gains even more.
A study by the Lake Victoria Fisheries Organization says the growing appetite in Asia for the swim bladder, once viewed as a waste byproduct, has created a multi-million dollar export business. Kenya, Tanzania and Uganda earn $86 million US, Uganda accounting for nearly half of the sales, making it the largest exporter of fish maw to China in 2017.
That's why we want to regulate it, so that our fish farmers and, of course, the fishmongers and the fisheries sector really benefit from this very lucrative business.
International prices of dry maw range between $450 and $1,000 per kilogram, depending on the size, quality, and market strength.
We have always known that it's a saleable commodity, but we sell it at low prices, so we have been exploited.
Fishermen sell it for lower prices to locals without the swim bladders, but fish processors want the entire fish. The Lake Victoria Fish Organization suggests fish maw be recognized as a commodity separate from fish. The Ugandan government is working to craft regulations for fish maw products. Athmani Halima for VOA News, Kampala.
This news from VOA Asia, police say Felix Dorfin, a French man accused of trafficking drugs, has broken out of an Indonesian jail by sawing through the bars and escaping through a second-story window. The 35-year-old Dorfin was awaiting trial in a possible death penalty case. All the big stories come your way on VOA 60 and VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, humanity's efforts to move into and peer into space seem to be experiencing something of a renaissance in the past few weeks. NASA's pictures of Ultima Thule continue to astound, as do Chinese pictures from their probe on the far side of the moon. VOA's Kevin Enix tells us coming soon, the James Webb Telescope will allow NASA to look even farther into the great beyond.
The James Webb Telescope is being prepped for launch in 2021, and it will change the way that NASA views the universe.
The James Webb is designed specifically to look into the infrared, and this is an area of the spectrum where we have looked before, but certainly never with anything as advanced as Webb. So the hope is that we're really going to expand what we understand about the universe in this regime.
The infrared spectrum not only allows astronomers to see things the human eye can't, but infrared waves are special in that they don't scatter as much as visible light does when passing through interstellar gas and dust. So the Webb telescope will see farther and better.
Webb is designed to observe the universe in the infrared. And by doing that, you open up a tremendous amount of new science that we can do. Two of the extremes are looking, first of all, at the most distant galaxies in the universe. Their light, because of the effect of cosmological redshift, is shifted all the way into the infrared. So we're only really able to observe those galaxies by looking in the infrared.
It's also just a much better telescope than Hubble, which has been in orbit since 1990.
It's a much larger mirror than Hubble, so it's 5 times larger in area than Hubble. It's also located at a much better place to actually put a telescope, so well beyond the orbit of the Earth. And this allows it, again, to see fainter objects. And in the intervening time, we've developed better instrumentation, so better cameras.
And it's just possible that the Webb telescope might be the tool that helps astronomers prove that we're not alone in the universe.
It's not really what Webb is designed to do, but part of Webb's mission is to find planets and to study their atmospheres. Now, there's possibilities that we might actually discover evidence or indirect evidence for life on these planets by looking at the chemistry in their atmospheres.
The telescope is scheduled to be launched in 2021 and will be deployed about 1.5 million kilometers from Earth. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
It has been 51 years since the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., the African-American preacher who led a civil rights movement that changed the nation and reverberated around the world. Since then, America has made great strides on race, but deep divisions still remain. VOA correspondent Mariama Diallo has more from the African-American and African immigrant experience when it comes to race in America today.
I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up.
August 29, 1963. It was a speech that galvanized a nation and put civil rights and economic justice at the forefront of the American conversation. Race, media, and communication professor from American University, Sherry Williams.
What he was really trying to do was achieve racial equality, and not just racial equality, but also economic justice. We know that right before he died, he was working on the Poor People's Campaign, and he was in Memphis working with sanitation workers who were on strike, who were basically just striving for a living wage.
Howard University's Greg Carr says while there has been some progress, economic disparities still exist.
If we look at Black America generally economically, a Black family in this country, the median wealth of Black households, for every dollar that a white household has, a Black household in this country has about 10 cents. One-tenth of the wealth of an average white household is in a Black household. That's absurd.
But the current relatively strong U.S. economy has boosted the job market for all races. The unemployment rate for Blacks fell below 6% last year, the lowest since 1972. Still, according to a recent Harvard University study, half of all Black Americans report experiencing discrimination in the workplace. Police brutality in predominantly African American communities is another source of concern.
No justice!
The Black Lives Matter movement that surfaced in 2014 after the shooting in the state of Missouri of a Black man by a white police officer has taken up that cause.
They open our eyes to everything. They help us understand that while we may not be seen as human or powerful currently, that the fruits of our labor will soon come.
Being Black in America has certainly changed since the famous Martin Luther King Jr. I Have a Dream speech. America twice voted for an African-American president in 2008 and again in 2012. But improving race relations, as evidenced by a recent resurgence of white supremacy groups, have quite a ways to go. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Washington.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. You'll find us on iTunes and SoundCloud, where you can download our program each and every day. You can also get our program from VOA Asia Facebook. And, of course, it's on our website, voanews.com. Write to us when you have a chance. VOA Asia at voanews.com is our email address. We'd love to hear from you. We'd love to hear from everybody who's been listening on the radio, U-Radio of Hatay University, FM 101.25 at Hatay University in Thailand. Thanks for tuning in. We thank our director, Tracy Carter, Aydin Utku, managing editor, Diane Gao, Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, and Anna Cook on our VOA Asia team. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a terrific day.